Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Sometimes the transition to fall and winter feels like experiencing every season on the same day. The shoes in the Allbirds Mizzle collection were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Check off your errands with the Wool Runner Mizzle, dash through cold and wet weather with the Wool Dasher Mizzle, or upgrade to next-level protection with the Wool Runner Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code Fresh Socks.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
I'm reunited with you.
It's been too long. It has. You're listening to a beautiful moment because although you've been hearing the podcast over the past few weeks, Ed and I haven't seen each other.
No, this
Our first time being in the same room for a month.
I know. It was quite an emotional reunion.
It really was.
I brought
was.
You some chocolate chip cookies.
I gave you a big hug even though I've got the lurgy.
Two hugs we actually had.
Yeah, that's how emotional the moment was.
It was really emotional. I missed you.
Yeah, so the last time we saw each other was for the live shows in Edinburgh, and then we've had our summer break. So, first day of the new term, what did you do on your holidays?
I was in Italy, and we had a nice time, got away from it all, didn't take my phone, which is a sort of practice I used to have as a leader, and I've now restarted.
Can we talk about the object you've brought with you today, then?
Yes.
I mean, Ed, it seems to me that you've been to the British Museum and asked to loan one of their valuable artefacts.
And I found a very old BlackBerry, which I which I got from just like somewhere. It was somewhere hidden in the attic.
You look like a time traveller with that thing.
It's got old emails from Gordon Brown on it, actually.
Ed's developed a twitch since looking at those
emails. No, I have not. It's very, very emotional. It was quite nice to have sort of detox from social media and all that.
So how are you finding it? Because we've said before, if I get up for a wee in the night, I have to look at Twitter. So are you not?
No. The gold standard is Ken Clark, right? He doesn't have a mobile phone at all. And so it's like very difficult to get hold of him. I'm not sure I'm going to meet the gold standard. You know, and there is a bit of a trend here about people are trying to, smart designers are now trying to design dumb phones, as they're calling them, you know, which can sort of just do text and phoning, but not anything else.
Because I've said this to Ed, so you've found this old BlackBerry, which, I don't know how long, I mean, it looks like it's on its last legs.
No, I think it's sort of been resuscitated. It's 13 years old or something, can, 15 years old.
But you can get these phones for, like, I know people of my parents' generation often like a very simple phone with big buttons. Have you not considered getting one of those?
The thing about BlackBerrys, you can text from it. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Anyway, but I think this is a sort of experiment, and it may all be like a holiday resolution which just disappears, but let's see.
But you've enjoyed it so far.
I have, yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, I would have liked to have talked to you, but
not even a postcard. Nary a postcard.
I did bring a chocolate chip cookie. And how was your holiday?
Well, I was in Edinburgh for a lot of it. So after we did our live shows up there, I stayed up there because my wife was doing a show at the Fringe Festival, and she ended up being on the best newcomer list.
I know, it's brilliant.
So what are we talking about on the episode then this week?
So we're talking about food waste, and it's just astonishing, as we'll hear from our guests, about the amount of food that is wasted both nationally and globally. We'll be talking about what the solutions are to this. And if you think about it, you know, you've got a planet which is growing in terms of the number of people on it. You've got massive issues of climate change, massive issues of food poverty. If there's all this food going to waste, there must be something better we can do. And so we've got two great guests to talk about it.
I very rarely leave anything on my plate.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You're making your own contribution.
Absolutely.
But what about your fridge?
Yeah, that's a less of a good picture.
Exactly. Really. We'll be talking about your fridge.
We'll also be joined by a comedian who I'm so excited to have on. He's really funny. He's on a Netflix 15-minute special. You'll also see him cropping up on telly a lot. He's really good. Phil Wang will be joining us to pitch ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful. So let's do our reasons to be cheerful then.
Yep, so my reason to be cheerful is seeing you again.
Oh, stop it.
I am. No, I missed you and I missed our sort of liaison.
Me too, but because you were on your digital detox, I couldn't get hold of you.
I know. Sorry about that. I was a little
upset that you didn't ask me to come to Italy with you.
Sorry about that. George Ezra all over again. He was in Italy, actually, as well. What about you? What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful, in an ongoing series of people I've interviewed for my Beatles show. So you remember a while ago I mentioned I'd interviewed Michael Palin about his love of the Beatles, and then I'd interviewed Ozzy Osbourne. This morning, I interviewed the man who used to be the Beatles' hairdresser.
Wow.
A guy called Leslie Cavendish.
Wow.
Yeah, he started off cutting Paul McCartney's hair. And their haircuts
are very famous.
Yeah, and the other Beatles liked it so much that they all eventually would
How
let him
fantastic.
Do that. Yeah, and he was great and he told some fantastic stories.
Does he still cut hair?
He doesn't actually. He makes a living. He's written a book about his time as the Beatles' hairdresser.
Right.
And he makes a living going around Beatles conventions answering questions.
And not cutting people's hair in a Beatles style.
No, I mean, you probably could make more than you could from the selfies.
Well, maybe I could ask him to, you know, give me a
mop top.
Yeah.
have you ever had long hair?
No. You've had long hair.
I have. I've been a right hippie at various times. But he was great. And he told a story about he was cutting the hair of a journalist. And he didn't smell a rat. And the journalist was just saying, so the heads of hair the Beatles have then, you know, who has the best hair? He said, they all have pretty good hair, really. You know, Paul, George, Ringo, all quite. John's hair's a bit thinner. And then the journalist went and ran this big story, which was the Beatles hairdresser says John Lennon is going bald.
Oh, my God.
And he had to deal with a very angry John Lennon on the other end of the phone.
Well, he sounds great.
Yeah, he was really good. So that's my reason to be cheerful.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined by Lindsay Boswell, who is chief executive of FairShare, and Sasha Celestial One, who's co-founder of Olio, the world's first food sharing app. Hello, both. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Can we start by asking you, not a small question, but Can you contextualise for us the scale of food waste, first in the UK and then what the picture is globally?
In total terms, one third of all food in the United Kingdom is wasted. One third of all food, which is a mad number. When you then boil that down even further, there is a part of it, and it's around about 270,000 tonnes, which is equivalent of 10 meals for every person in the country, man, woman and child, not houses.
10 meals a year.
10 meals per person per year. So 650 million meals worth is technically classified as yummy. It's in date, it's fit to be retailed, it's fit to be sold, and it's fantastic food. And vast majority of that goes to waste.
650 million meals.
Mm.
It's the same globally, a third. Some countries better than others, but for the most part, between 33 and 50% of all food produced globally goes to waste. And then meanwhile, nearly a billion people go to bed hungry every night. So is this huge sense of, you know, too much on the one hand and just not enough where it needs to be on the other hand.
So as a planet, if we eliminated food waste and it was all eaten, theoretically, nobody goes hungry.
And also the climate effects and of all this excess production.
74% of deforestation is to grow food. One third of all food doesn't feed people.
Wow.
25% of the world's fresh water supply goes to grow food that's never eaten. every which way you look at it, it's a massive inefficiency.
Massive problem.
And then there's the opportunity cost as well. Imagine if all of those resources, labor, land, et cetera, were rediverted to something that's more beneficial than growing food no one ever eats. It's just, for me, I found, when I found out about the scale, I was horrified.
It's horrific. Can we talk about some of the reasons behind it? So this isn't just...
Your fridge.
Well, I do think, like, is it just people like me who buy too much food and then we can only follow recipes, we don't know what to do with it? Is it people worrying about sell-by dates?
Yeah, where are the bits in the chain?
Yeah, yeah. Or is it sort of an industrial level? Where's it happening?
And the answer is yes.
Right,
so four of us sat around this table.
Yeah.
50% of the food waste in the UK is wasted at the household level.
Right.
Wow. 22% of the weekly grocery shop is wasted by each household.
The equivalent of a damn good holiday.
Yeah. So can I just tell you, you guys are pretty good at this.
And if you think about...
And they've got the job already, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. The thing is that we live in a globalized food supply system. So when I buy a packet of blueberries, 25% of which I don't eat, that is food that was exported or imported from somewhere else. And those farmers then have to grow extra crops. And those crops also have to meet certain cosmetic standards to be accepted by the supermarkets. And there's this whole sort of butterfly effect, or blueberry effect, that, in my opinion, a lot of ways, you know, it does sort of stem with the ultimate person who's eating that food.
So 50% of it's at the household level. Where's the rest of it?
Well, in the food industry. And the food industry is really, really good at making a loud noise, at pointing at us, the consumer.
Mm. And we are pretty bad, but we're only 50%
we're only half of the problem.
But there are 65 million individual problems to try and solve. Yeah. And whereas our focus is very much on saying there are scalable solutions within the food industry because it's a big beast. And actually, if you start to correct the problems within that big beast, then actually you can make a real difference. The problem fundamentally comes down to supply and demand. That's at the heart of it. Now, what I mean by that is the food industry believes, and I think they might be right here, that if you go into one supermarket and you want a particular product, and there's another supermarket just across the road, and they haven't got the product you want, you'll walk out and you'll go to their rival.
Strawberries.
And so, therefore, they want the shelves full all the time. And that's resulted in, strawberries in February, and all sorts of weird products that, you know, you end up seeing. And if you're one of the supermarkets and I'm a pie manufacturer, you want me to supply you with 100,000 pies a day.
Yeah.
So I'm delighted I've just won this amazing contract because it's worth a lot of money to me. So I've gone and built a factory on the basis of that. And actually, the mechanical engineers who built my pie-making machinery, the optimum level of that running might not be exactly 100,000 pies a day. So already I'm probably producing slightly more pies because it doesn't make business sense to switch my machines off. But equally, you're measuring me on my ability to give you 100,000 perfect pies on time. And it makes good business sense in order to retain you as my biggest customer that actually I aim off slightly, just in case, I don't know.
You produce more.
Yeah.
So. Like a margin of error.
A margin of error. Yeah. Because one of the lorries might crash and I've got to put a replacement in. There might be a snow, there might be a terrorist incident. One of the ovens might be too hot and they all come out black. There are thousands and thousands of reasons.
Ed isn't going to say yes to an imperfect pie.
Definitely not. No, I am. Sorry.
No, in this scenario.
Wrong answer. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Send that pie back.
So I, as the pie manufacturer, I'm aiming off, but I'm doing the same to my meat supplier, and I'm doing the same to my gravy supplier, and I'm doing the same to my pastry supplier.
So everyone
produces to excess.
And you don't want to have an empty shelf where you're selling pies either. So there's this sort of built-in excess at every single stage. And the pies might be round when they could be square, which means all the pie, there's all just kind of things that collectively add up to a massive waste of resources.
But also your point is that every supermarket's got to do this so that they, or every shop.
Well, the genie's out of the bottle. I mean, we should be in a place where we go, do you know what? It's February. There are no strawberries. But you know that the rival down the road is going to go, no, we can get the Spanish.
And why does that make it worse? Because if people don't buy the strawberries
Because we're so used to the choice, right?
Because we need everything all the time.
If you're growing out of season, then you have to go, you have to import that from further away,
right.
Which introduces longer sort of periods between origination and consumption, which means there's more steps or possibility for things to perish along the way.
This is probably a kind of impossible question to answer, but do we know whether this problem has got worse over time? Do we know whether other countries do it better than us?
There's some research came out relatively recently that it is getting worse.
Yeah. And that's from the government's own organization.
But if it was a third is wasted now, you can't quantify what it was like 20, 30, 40 years ago.
If you go back 50 years ago, like a generation ago, the idea of wasting food was completely taboo. And that's sort of post-war mentality.
Yeah.
I think it's become much more normalized now. And that our current generation, over the last 20, 30 years, expects convenience, choice, variety instantly at all times. And also, there's a lot of research to show that the price of food as part of the average household budget has decreased significantly. So if you can buy a banana for 12p, it's hard to get too financially attached to that for the average person. So if it goes brown in the fruit bowl, well, it looked nice, right? But meanwhile, it was imported from the other side of the planet. Food's cheap for a lot of people. For many people, the 8 million people who are living on the breadline, literally, it's not cheap, but it has decreased.
So that all sounds pretty bad.
People need to be more like my mother-in-law. Anything left over, it goes into a frittata. Frittatas could be part of the solution.
I except for strawberries and a frittata,
I think it's smoothie. She would do it.
Everyone, I think it needs to... Sorry, I'm just thinking out loud here, but eating strawberries in February needs to be taboo.
How do you change that mentality, though? Like you're saying, consumers are so used to having everything like what they want when they want it, and you're asking people to sort of think about this stuff more and change their habits and think about what's seasonal.
Well, I think more and more and more people are taking those individual choices.
Yeah,
whether that's a whether that's a choice that's open to everybody in society is a moot point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're also saying target the manufacturers and the producers.
Yeah, I mean that's where the real bulk surplus exists, and that's where seismic change can really happen.
And this is good, but we're onto sort of the sunny uplands here of the solutions.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about what you think the solutions can be, Lindsay, and then it would be good to hear from Sasha as well.
I haven't met a single person. I've been doing this job for 8 years. I haven't met a single person in the food industry that doesn't believe that good quality food should be made available to feed people, and if they've got surplus, they should do that with it. We've grown slowly and incrementally over time.
Just say a bit about what Fair Share does, just because it'll...
Yeah, so we're a redistribution charity where we try and present the food industry, because food industry is big, ugly, and incredibly impatient. So it moves at amazing pace and speed. And then the voluntary sector, the charities, are thousands and thousands of little small groups, all who want a little bit of food, and trying to match those two is very difficult. So we operate across the whole of the UK. We're a UK only organization, but we have sister organizations pretty much in every country around the world. And what it looks like is we have 21 warehouses in the UK, all manned by armies of incredible volunteers, and we get the food industry to give us the food. We then sort out when we've got, as I saw this morning, 5-6 pallets worth of melons from Spain, and we'll work out which are the breakfast clubs, which of the domestic violence refuges, which are the mental health homes, etc., etc. We'll want that product, and we'll put an order together for them. We'll ring them up, say, this is what we've got for you, and we will then save those organisations money because they otherwise have to go out and buy that food.
And the supermarket's giving you the melons because...
Because we're finally beginning to get
that they can't use them for some reason.
They may be too yellow, they may be too pointy,
okay,
or they may just be that actually the melon supplier has sent more melons in order to,
like the pie man,
to be the supply and demand.
And so then you send them on to the charity that wants them.
We'll send the food on to the charities, and headline terms, 750,000 people a week are being fed through 10,000 frontline charity and community groups across the four nations of the UK. And but the really big number is a very small one, which is that's only 6%.
Yeah. And so what else could we be doing?
We could be doing what the rest of Europe and North America does, which is operating at a much, much bigger scale. So our ambition, and what gets me out of bed every morning and the team at FairShare and all the volunteers, is we want to take that 6% to 25%, and we want to grow phenomenally to be able to supply all of the charities in the United Kingdom with all of them.
And how can you do that? What needs to happen? What does government need to do, or what does business need to do to make that happen?
The food industry needs to recognise that when it has a problem, i.e. we've got two pallets of product sitting over there that's perhaps got a slightly shorter date, still have plenty of life left on it, that they don't just shove it into a corner and only deal with it when it's about to cost them money, but they put a system and they process in
place. And some of them do and some of them don't.
Some of them do, which is why we...
That's the 6%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
a lot of them don't. I mean, yeah. Do you want to...
I mean, do they... We've talked about this before, and I'm far from an expert here, but my understanding is that they're not properly incentivized the way they are in the US and in other countries from a tax perspective specifically. My belief is that in the US, donating food is a tax write-off in terms of the cost of goods that donated. So there's some incentive there. Is that correct?
So we've got this thing called the Jeffocracy, which you'd probably know about.
Yep.
I felt from the moment you walked in the room, frankly, that I don't know what Jeff thinks, but you should be the kind of ministers for food.
Yeah, this is what I've been thinking.
You always have to be careful with him because, he says he's a benign dictator, but you never quite know, what side of bed he got out of in the morning. but let's say he made you both the ministers of food and you've got total free hand, what would you do?
Right. So first of all, I would put some punitive pressures onto the food industry to say wasting food whilst there are people who are hungry in the UK is just not acceptable.
You're not allowed to do it in France. You have to place a fine. Is that right?
So, well, let's come to France in just a second, because it's really helpful having just 26 miles across the English Channel, a really, really good example.
Yeah.
Because the thing that's really different in France is that if you are a French food business, it will cost you no more to dispose of food by giving it to the Fair Share equivalent than it would any other form of disposal. I'm not going to make money on the fact that I've got surplus food, but it won't cost me more.
So how does it cost companies over here to give food to you?
Well, ironically, partly because of a really, really magical government intervention that has the inevitable law of the unforeseen consequences, which is anaerobic digestion. Now, the UK is one of the top five anaerobic digestion countries in the world. And I have to say, as a Brit, I'm incredibly proud that we are up there in turning waste food into energy. However, that's meant to be our food caddies and the bins in all of our houses. But because it isn't, because the contracts with the local authorities are run for 40 odd years or so, and only a little bit of that food is going into anaerobic digestion. That's these big, these big sort of soup making machines that produces a gas, and that gas is turned into energy, and that feeds into the national grid,
which need to run at a minimum capacity to be efficient.
Yeah, it's coming from the supermarkets.
In theory, all of that really should be coming from consumer waste. And so actually our biggest competitor, FairShare's biggest competitor, is the anaerobic digestion industry, which has all sorts of tax breaks.
I see.
And so we're saying to the government, or what we would like the government to do, say, we believe in order to get like France and get to 100,000 tonnes of food being redistributed each year, and I'll tell you what the value to society is of that in a second. If we could get to 100,000 tons of food redistributed each year, it would only cost £15 million in terms of equalising subsidies for the food industry. So just to be clear, that's not the charity sector saying we need £15 million. That's saying small food businesses that can't afford to keep that food in date and to transport it to us need a subsidy to be able to do that.
Right. As opposed to not sending it to anaerobic digestion.
Correct.
Right.
Because obviously, if to send it anaerobic digestion, you can just put it into a bucket.
I see.
You don't need to look after it.
I see.
And the AD industry, through
they don't get money for that, or they do.
Well, some of it depends. Some of them will do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you need to level the playing field one way or another.
That's the phrase we constantly use. Yeah. Level playing field. But the value, if we got to that, we had that same tax break that, or the same incentive that exists in France. The value of that to frontline charities in the UK would be between £250 and £300 million a year.
Right, so it could make a big difference. We should bring Sasha in to say what else do you think we should be doing?
So Olio is a free platform, mobile and desktop app. Basically, it connects neighbors with each other so that they can share food. And it also connects volunteers who collect unsold food from local businesses that isn't being collected by the charitable sector with their neighbors. So we have about 600,000 people who've signed up to our food sharing revolution. And
in 3 years.
Yeah, in just under 3 years. So we're growing really quickly. I'm very proud of our traction. It's a drop in the ocean in terms of impact compared to what FairShare has accomplished so far. But as we discussed earlier, 50% of food waste does take place in the home. So it's just broken up into millions and millions and millions of little households. So if I'm an individual and I have a glut for my allotment, we're seeing a lot of courgettes and marrows and things right now, or I've overcatered for a party or I'm going on holiday, anytime I've got surplus food, I can take a picture, upload it to the app, and it'll instantly alert people nearby food's available, and your neighbor pops around and picks it up. So it's a really, it ticks a number of boxes. It stops good food from going to waste. It connects people who live in communities, especially in places like London. A lot of times we don't know our neighbors, and there's that sort of sense of urban isolation.
And what proportion of the people who are receiving the food are below the poverty line? A significant proportion.
So up to half of the people who are requesting food are living in households below the poverty line. And that's really important because it means that food is often going to those people who need it the most. But we are really, there's also people who aren't necessarily living on a tight food budget, but who care about the environment or want to connect with their community. And we are very, very careful to not try and make Olio a situation where the haves are giving to the have-nots for a variety of reasons. One, the kind of food that's on Olio is often very short shelf life, so, needs to be eaten today. And the reality is there's not always conveniently a very hungry or needy person in walking distance who's able to come and collect that food. So if we want to reduce food waste as much as possible, which is our objective because of the environmental tragic nature of food waste, then we need to make it so that everyone can participate. So we don't discriminate between who collects or who adds.
Of course.
It's for everyone. It's just what a modern, sustainable individual would do. It's a delight. And I'm incredibly proud of the number of people who have written to us to let us know that, they wouldn't have been able to feed their family that night if they hadn't collected certain bits of food on Olio, et cetera. One of the things.
So you're working at the other 50%.
We are working at the other 50%. Like, our grand vision is that, in 5-10 years' time, we have 1 billion people signed up to Olio all around the world. People hate wasting food. Our species did not evolve to throw away good food. And the joy of sharing food is really just something that's profoundly human. And this is evidenced by the fact that we've seen food sharing successfully take place in 32 countries so far. And these are small micro communities of people who want to connect to share food. And this is all done through a grassroots volunteer program we have. Which is, so far we've seen over 20,000 people sign up. So we definitely are on to something.
Mega
that's
numbers.
Pretty amazing. What we have to do is change consumer behavior, and we have to get people to recognize, the day before the salad turns into a pile of mush, which is not edible at that point, to do the mental math to say, actually, I'm going out tomorrow night.
Yeah.
I bought the salad on Sunday when I had really good intentions of being healthy all week, but I'm not going to eat it in time. It's still perfectly edible. So pop it on the app. 50% of all food listings globally are requested in under an hour. It's hard to imagine. It's hard if you come especially from a home that's got a lot of food, just how many people are need or want.
And what proportion of the food that's uploaded onto your site gets taken up?
Between 70 and 95%, depending on the location.
That's incredible.
Wow.
It's an incredibly effective marketplace.
Wow.
And as we like to say, you cannot underestimate how many people want free food. So what would I do? I would make putting Olio on your smartphone mandatory for all the mobile carriers. I would work with all the local authorities and make sure that it's included, that all the residents know about it. I would address best before dates. Just this morning, I was looking at the European Commission's website. They have a recent report out that says that 10% of the 88 million tons of food that is wasted each year in the EU is due to confusion about best before dates.
So can we talk a little bit about that? Because is it more
the
important?
The sell by and best before.
Yeah, and also
and use by.
If you
use
were to by. Give somebody...
Sell by's gone, use by, sorry.
To give somebody food outside of the use by dates, are you liable if they get salmonella or...
You cannot give someone food from as a business when it's not safe to eat, and food that's past its use by date is deemed not safe to eat.
But that's not necessarily the case, though. That's
with best before, which is an indicator of quality, not safety, and you can give or donate food and sell food past the best before, and it'd be perfectly edible depending on the product for months, if not years.
So best before is before use by, correct?
So I just get to,
I'm now really confused.
Yeah. Okay, I just find these dates very scary.
Yeah. Okay, if we've got two highly articulate, intelligent guys like struggling on this issue, then that shows that actually more needs to be done in this space, and we all recognize that. Use by is a safety issue. So if you eat something after the use by date, there is a chance that you are going to fall ill. So things like shellfish and eggs, etc., have use-by dates on them. Best before is an advisory date,
right?
That is meant to be telling you that you're going to have the optimal experience of that product if you eat it before that date.
But your Rice Krispies are not going to poison you,
correct?
After the best before,
and indeed, what many people don't realise is that it is perfectly legal. It would be perfectly legal for a shop to sell those Rice Krispies after their best before date, because it is only advisory.
But are they set by regulation when the best before and the use by dates are set? So it's not a problem about when the dates are, it's a problem about the way the dates are interpreted.
Right, so the regulations stipulate what foods have to have a use by date and what foods don't. It is up to, the brand police in each of those products to establish what should be the best before date.
So is best before date actually unhelpful because it just confuses people?
I'm trying to think of a product off the top of my head here, but you've got a range of product in front of you.
Twix.
And some of it, well, no, because that's just basically sugar and it lasts forever.
All right.
But there are
other chocolate bars available.
Thank goodness.
This podcast is not sponsored by Twix.
Exactly.
The crunchy chocolate melts in the middle.
You know, if you've got two products and one is much older than the other, you want to be able to have a way of telling that. Now, thank goodness, when it comes to fruit and veg, we can tell with our eyes, mostly. But, you know, if you've got two loaves of bread in a high mass manufacturer in a bag, you want to know that that's going to last you
it's a bit of a mess. How do we sort this out? What do we do? We've appointed
you. Maths from the use before date, though. Use by date.
Well, hang on a sec.
But it doesn't have a use by date because stale bread.
Salmonella. Okay.
You could put the manufacture date on it and then let people deduct what is for them the optimal.
Well, listen, you've got the job. You're ministers of food. Come on, ministers. Okay. You've been called in by Jeff. He's got that with Sky TV.
My solution is to go back to my boss, Jeff, and say, right, well, you need to sort out the Ministry of Education and make sure that every kid understands food and is taught to cook.
Yeah.
And then they'll understand best before and use by date.
So basically dial down the people's paranoia about best before, while use by is probably sensible not to get poisoned.
I personally don't see a solution.
Tesco just a couple months ago removed best before dates from 70 of their products, including lemons and potatoes.
Wow.
So this is just common sense if you are familiar with the kitchen and cooking. Yeah. If you're not familiar with how to cook and everything you buy, for whatever reason, is prepared and you're not familiar with raw ingredients, then you can't use common sense to make that differentiation. And you may make a conservative choice to throw away something when it's perfectly edible for days or weeks. So I completely agree with Lindsay that there's a real lack of just home economics awareness that can be reinstituted.
Every kid should leave school being able to cook five main meals.
Yeah.
And they can be different ones for their own cultural background, but five established main meals.
What else do we need to do? I mean, you've got a pretty good agenda, but anything else that you would make a big difference here?
There is some debate and discussion because, you know, you mentioned France earlier on and lots of people go around, yeah, but do we need what they have in France? The French introduced a law that said if you are a food business, you're a retailer, you're a shop, and you've got more than, I think it's five outlets, then you need to have a policy in place. If a charity comes along and says, can we have your leftovers, that you've got a system to be able to give them that. And I think that's quite a useful and helpful system. The French, our French equivalent, so our sister organization in France, actually tell us that, well, that's all already in place. Mm. There's another issue, which is if you go into central London, at the end of the day, you will see bags of food, sandwiches and salads, tied up, and they are sat on the same pavement that a homeless person is sat on.
Yeah, I know.
And there's something fundamentally wrong with our society when we've got a hungry person sitting on the same pavement as food. Now, that's the only way that that business has to dispose of, other than give it away, which is obviously what we would prefer them to do. Although a life of just purely eating sandwiches isn't really not good for your health.
I can vouch for that.
Other foods are available. Mm-hmm. So what quite a few of those businesses do is pour bleach and dyes into the to stop.
Or just open them up.
And they're not, I mean, basically, but what is going to force them to do something about this? Because, you know, goodwill is obviously not quite,
I don't think that you get the same objection up the supply chain when you're speaking with more sophisticated organizations in the food industry. But we have about 1,500 trained volunteers who we call Food Waste Heroes, who collect unsold food from local businesses. That's usually small quantities of same day, delis, sandwiches, salads, that type of food.
Who need to know what to do with it?
Well, they take the food home, they add it to the app, they're all trained, et cetera, and their neighbors come around and pick it up.
But it sounds like Lindsay's talking about the big manufacturers.
They're all individual shops. And so we go to those and we say, hey, this volunteer is going to pick up we have volunteers who can collect this food for free, although we do have a paid model, but let's not go there, for free, and make sure that it's eaten by members of the local community. And one of our biggest objections we get is they say, they talk about liability. And they just don't understand the idea that, if it's given to a trained volunteer, then the volunteer assumes liability for that food.
And in the USA, there's a law that exempts anybody from giving away food from liability if the recipient gets sick. We don't need that necessarily.
I certainly think that it's worth exploring, and that in countries where they have that, especially small businesses who are confused by the legal system are more inclined to donate their unsold food. We also work with, Sainsbury's and Pret and some larger organizations who understand that, and that's not a barrier to them for donating. But the independently owned and managed store, is all they hear is headlines, but you're going to get sued, you're going to get sued. And it puts a lot of fear into people who may otherwise donate their food. So I do think that would be an important.
So that's called the Good Samaritan law in the States. If that's going to work for persuading the high street to change its behaviour, then we're all in favour of it. What we're worried about is a big debate within the food industry about introducing the Good Samaritan law, and it then not being introduced. Last 20 years, most governments have been really, really clear about wanting to minimise bureaucracy for business. So if there's a big debate about it and it then doesn't happen, our worry is it actually then sets us even further back because people go, hang on, I can't give you this because the Good Samaritan law wasn't passed.
Yeah, and it has been introduced before here in the UK and it hasn't passed. So it is not very clear cut.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
I think Olio is most amazing success.
Thank you. This is literally the tip of the iceberg. We have people downloading the app all over the world. And it's one of those things where the more people who join, the better it becomes for everyone. And we everyone thinks that throwing away perfectly good food when it could be eaten is senseless, right? No, there's it's just part of who we are as humans. What they forget is that we can do something about it, and it's not that hard. Oleo just needs to be slightly more fun than putting something in the bin, and it really is. You put something on the app, a neighbor comes by, and it's we're building connections, real connections in the community. So I think at the most basic level, I would encourage people to download the app, tell 10 friends, and have a cupboard clear out. And that's the only way to get started.
Okay.
So
Lindsay?
So really practical. Yeah. You know, there are things people can do. You can sign up and use Oleo. Our 21 warehouses across the UK, although we have around about 1,000 regular volunteers, we need many, many more. Mm. There is some really practical stuff that people can do. And if you are miles away, then you can actually lend your voice to us, and we can persuade the government to change things.
Lindsay Boswell from Fair Share and Sasha Celestial One from Oleo, thank you so much.
That was crunchy.
Well, here's the thing: the numbers are horrendous.
Much worse than I thought. Actually.
Ashamed of yourself, but I just thought, as often is the case on the podcast, like it was just great to speak to inspiring people,
definitely,
with ideas about how to fix it.
And I would really encourage people to get involved with Fair Share, get involved with Oleo or other organisations that are doing similar things, because, it is where citizens can make a difference. I also think, you know, it makes me want to find out more about some of the local shops around me, just, you know, what are they actually up to and, you know, what are they doing? And I think there should be a way of knowing who are the good ones, who aren't doing the right things. I think this is where an area where consumer pressure could make a big difference.
Like some of the traffic
light system. Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Well, we would love to hear from you if you want to send us an email. We've got that new term feeling.
Definitely.
And we're thinking about
vim and vigour.
We have got vim and vigour, yeah. And we're thinking about the different subjects we want to be talking about throughout the autumn. And if you've got ideas for episodes, we've had some good ones in
definitely
over the summer, but we'd love more. We'd also like your thoughts on food waste. On this, you know, if you ever want to take these ideas that we talk about on the podcast and see if you can get some movement on them in real life, talking to local businesses, for example, on food waste, and tell us the stories of how you've been able to put these ideas into action.
Definitely.
We would love to hear from you. It is reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. I have an email here from Rachel Finn, who says, I've long since learned that I shouldn't expect the topic of your podcast to bear any relation to how much I enjoy it. I think we feel the same way.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And today, that was never more true. Today's guests were spectacular, inspiring, moving, and despite the apparent enormity of the issue at hand, optimistic.
This is Karen McCluskey and Louisa O'Malland. I probably my favourite episode.
Astonishing episode.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the best live show we've ever done.
Yeah.
Rachel continues, I just ended up sitting in my car in the office car park, catching my breath and waiting for the lump in my throat to go. I made it safely into the office now, but decided to start the week with a donation to Helena's Hospice Foundation and an email to you
great
and the team, Essential Listening.
Well, that's great. We've also had one from Andrew Turner, and it's entitled The Super Sewer. People might remember, it was my reason to be cheerful from the episode we did at the Lunar Festival. Ed, I'm glad you're bringing your children up to appreciate the important work done by our civil engineers in building infrastructure for the future. It was more my in-laws, but I'll take the credit. You'll be glad to hear that at least one of your loyal podcast listeners is helping to build the Thames Tideway Tunnel, aka the Super Sewer. 3 weeks ago, I and a number of colleagues pumped 3,350 cubic metres, approximately 8,000 tonnes of concrete, 50 metres down to the bottom of one of the Thames Tideway construction shafts. I've attached a site report for your information and that of your sons. I have many other site reports reports describing my company's concrete pumping exploits. They're available on request. I'm kind of wondering about a visit to the super sewer, actually.
Firstly, I mean, your boys are going to be over the moon at seeing that site report.
Definitely.
They're so fascinated.
No, I know. I mean, look, honestly, the super sewer is, you know, it's got a life of its own.
Are you suggesting we do a live show down the super sewer?
Mate, now there, you know, you might be talking.
And this comes from Tom Reed Cutting, who says, "Dear Cheerful Podcast, I am just writing to how one should conduct themselves around people they find inspiring without making those people feel uncomfortable. For example, the other day I was listening to Reasons to Be Cheerful and then happened to walk past Ed and his family. At first, though, I thought Ed was simply someone with a passing resemblance to the real deal. So this brought my father's attention where otherwise wouldn't have, and it definitely wasn't subtle. I'm really, really sorry if people doing things like that makes you uncomfortable." Firstly, I think you're pretty good with that. If you notice people kind of looking at you, you're the first to say, "Hey, would you like a selfie with me, Ed Miliband?"
I'll tell you a story about that in a sec. Googie, carry on to the end of his email.
All right. He says, so the question is, would you like it if people come up to you and say that they find you inspiring?
Definitely.
Or would you rather we didn't, so you can mind your own business? Anyway, now that I'm able to do so, thank you for being so inspiring.
Aww.
Yeah, there we go.
No, it's funny you should say this, because I had this experience going on holiday. This guy in the queue in the queue at the airport was took a photo of me, just sort of from, you know, we were still snaking around the queue, and he took a photo of me. I sort of, like, he thought he was being surreptitious, took a photo. And I, you know, I've said to you before, I really like it when people come up to me and say, "Can I have a photo?" I don't love the sort of sneaky photo.
One, yeah.
So I thought I had sort of this sort of brainwave, which I took a photo of him. and his girlfriend was there, just absolutely sort of is hilarious. So I started taking a photo of him, and he looked just like, "Right, why is Ed Miliband taking a photo of me?" Anyway, he then came up to me, and we had a photo. We had a nice chat. But I thought it was quite
a good innovative technique. Neutralize it. Yeah, exactly.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
And here to pitch some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, comedian Phil Wang. Hello.
Hi, guys. Lovely to be here.
Hi. Well, it's lovely having you here, but there's already a bit of an atmosphere due to your wardrobe choice. It's Ed is sitting there with his arms folded.
It's
You're not
true.
Happy, are you?
Well, I'd sort of let him off because he's wearing a New York Yankees shirt, but he's a new fan. So, you know, and I'm a big Boston Red Sox fan. They have this big rivalry. So
Red Ed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but I think it's okay because you're like a recent.
I'm a recent convert.
How did you become a convert?
I'll be honest, it's a sartorial decision above anything else. I just like the tops.
I mean, it is a nice top.
It's
I hate
a lovely
to say
top,
it.
Nice thin lines. Their star pitchers, Japanese. I think that's wicked.
Yeah. Tanaka.
Tanaka. He's very good. Also, it just was the city that I was in.
Yeah, but you're 8.5 games behind the Red Sox, so.
Oh, great. Well, I'm very happy
anyway,
for you
as a
lifelong Yankees fan.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. How long do you think you need to be a fan for before you can start getting into the banter and the rivalry?
Well, turns out a month.
Yeah.
About a
definitely.
Month.
Definitely.
Phil, you've brought a bunch of ideas in. Do you want to start rattling through them?
Oh, I'd love to. The first is, I think, pretty common one. It's to do with pedestrians. And essentially, like, groups of three or more people on a pavement should have to form a single line because we just don't have the space. And extending this, I think we should have a highway code for pedestrians.
You're asking three people together, three pals walking down the street to go in single file. You're removing the social aspect. Could you not get them in at some kind of triangle formation? Would that be acceptable?
A triangle formation.
So you'd have two people chatting and one person goes ahead. They're the leader, if
the
you
vanguard.
Like. The vanguard, exactly.
But they're left somewhat out of the conversation, aren't they?
But maybe you could rotate it every 10 minutes.
Okay, so also a spinning triangle of people.
Yes.
That sounds good. Yeah. And maybe for people who need to check their phones, sort of lay-by system. So from time to time, a hard shoulder that you can creep into and stop.
Right, okay, we like that. We like that. Highway code for pedestrians, yeah.
Bigotry. Now, I think, you know, as we're all aware, we live in fractious times. And I think instead of vilifying people who hold ignorant views, they should have to pay for those views in a more bespoke manner. So essentially, you're allowed to be bigoted or ignorant about things, but you're not allowed to enjoy the fruits of the groups or beliefs that
you
have rejected.
I love this idea.
So, For example, if you're a creationist, you're not allowed fossil fuels. Or if you're a homophobe, you know, because of Alan Turing's essential contributions to computing, yeah. you're not allowed computers or Turing machines. And if you're a flat earther, you're not allowed a normal day cycle. So you can't,
this is great.
You can't have clocks.
If you're a racist, you're not allowed to enjoy any kind of music that is influenced.
I guess. Yes, that also works. But it has to work always in all directions. And maybe I should.
You're really thinking this through, Phil.
I have.
He's stroking his chin.
Phil is. We've established that Phil is an engineer by background, which makes you a very clear on logic, correct?
Yes, but emotionally cold.
Right.
And so I need to be tempered by you, humanitarian.
No, but I think I like this idea.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, sort of, it's a sort of practice what you preach.
Yeah.
Yes, I think what I'm calling for is a logical and ideological consistency. That's all I'm asking for, I think.
A bit of consistency.
Next up, a blackcurrant should be the default Lemsip flavour.
Ooh.
This is a few steps down.
Would you even still call it Lemsip if blackcurrant was the default flavour?
I think that would have to be a concession made to the Lemsip traditionalists, and I'm happy to make that.
What is the default at the moment? Lemon?
Yeah.
Lemon, yeah. But blackcurrant's the superior flavour, and people don't like to talk about it. Yeah, it's what
blackcurrant is a superior flavour.
Because
I prefer blackcurrant, actually.
I prefer blackcurrant, but I will sometimes have the lemon flavour because I think it's, you know...
It could be too much, the blackcurrant, though.
But the lemon's, like, refreshing. You don't, and you have lemsip before you go to bed. You don't want a zippy taste in your mouth just before you go to bed.
Yeah.
You want something soothing and
dark
and rich.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Are you sure it's not the default?
Lemon is definitely
the default. Lemsip.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
The next piece of my manifesto is to do with whitewashing, you know, the problem of whitewashing.
What do you want to do about this?
I think a tit-for-tat system. So... For every film in which a traditionally non-white character is played by a white actor, there should be a reciprocal film in which a traditionally white character is played by a non-white actor.
Okay.
So, for example, if Matt Damon is in The Great Wall, I get to be Marie Antoinette. You know, I think just...
You would be a very good Marie Antoinette because of that cold, emotionless thing.
And how much cake I eat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And my big wigs.
I think you deliver the let them eat cake line coldly and emotionally.
With my mouth full of cake.
Yeah.
You might not even be able to hear. Eventually, this just leads to a raceless world, right? If we can all play each other, why not? This next one, I've come to realize, actually already is in effect, but I'll say it anyway. So at restaurants, you should be able to try a bit of your food before committing to it like you can with wine.
This is in effect.
It is, because, well, if you don't like a dish, you can send it back.
Not really, though.
The other day, I had a green vegetable curry that was so salty, it was like eating the sea. But I didn't want to send it back because I thought, well, maybe the chef knows more than I do. I mean, right, this is borderline
you're such
inedible.
A nice person.
Yeah.
As opposed to borderline millennial. borderline inedible for the borderline millennial. But that's because you're such a nice person, though.
Yeah. But
you don't want to sort of offend somebody.
You would be happy to order a dish and then say, nah, not to my taste, I'll have something else, please. Strike it off the bill. This
it takes
what you're
quite
saying.
A lot of chutzpah to do
it
that,
does.
Doesn't it, really?
I sent my first bottle of wine back in New York recently.
How did that feel? Did you feel like a king?
Was it at Yankee Stadium?
Yeah. They're trying to get classy.
Yeah.
It was at a classy-ish restaurant.
Classy-ish.
I guess you'd call it classy.
Yeah.
And the wine we got was... I just thought it was very sour. What makes it muddy is that I did the test, and I said... Yeah, that's fine. And the waitress left. And then after a few more tastes of this wine, I thought, this is actually, it doesn't taste good. So I asked her back and I said, I think this is corked. And she looked quite shocked. And so she went, oh, I'll just get our sommelier. And so I felt like I was being sent to the principal's office. And so she took the bottle over to him. He gave it a whiff. He didn't seem convinced. And he tried a bit. And he came over and he said exactly what I was fearing he'd say. He said, this is not corked. And... But at this point, it's fight or flight, isn't it? And I chose a fight. And I said, it's very acrid. I just tried to use it.
Oh, good choice of words.
Yeah, it's a bit acrid.
And what did he say? He punched you on the nose.
He bottled me with the bottle that I sent back. I think that's tradition. Eventually, he said, you can change it. If I get another bottle, it tastes exactly the same. So fine, I'll change it. And I got another bottle, which was also a bit sour. But not as bad.
Your honor was saved.
My honor was saved. I think he looked at our table like we were all trash for the rest of the evening, but my honor to myself was saved.
I don't think I would like pull that off.
I think technically you can only send a bottle of wine back if it is genuinely corked or if the date on the label doesn't match the date on the cork.
Oh,
I think that's that. Those are the rules.
Wow!
And I say this as somebody who's been sober for 18 years.
Yeah, so it's impressive.
And when I was drinking, I wasn't really worried about the quality of the wine.
Well, it's obvious you haven't been thinking about it since.
No. But I'm not sure about sending about the food. I think sending about the food is even a higher bar, really.
Yeah. Really, I send stuff back all the time.
You send food back.
Sent dishes I finished back.
Because with hindsight,
successfully, I went through a phase of actually pushing my luck too much, but I'm out of that difficult.
Okay, no, it's impressive.
Now. Yeah, summer should be phased out. I've had enough of summer. I don't like summer at all. I think it's too
hot. You
don't
like the hot weather.
I grew up on the equator, climate. So I've had all the heat I need for my life.
Don't you love the long days, though? I think that is...
I like long nights. I don't like the early mornings. Right. I don't like how early the sun comes out. I like the temperature in the evening. But I don't like how chatty everyone is.
No.
And I don't like everyone taking their clothes off.
Here we go. I'm with Phil on this.
I don't like people playing games in the park.
Yeah.
I like winter where everyone shuts up.
Yeah.
Covers
really?
Up.
Yes.
And stays inside.
Yeah, and you
are
have
you
people,
serious
yeah,
about
people
this?
Dress like a child in the summer.
And it's fine.
I think it's
like the Purge or something. We're all allowed to be assholes for a whole season.
Well, never do you think people are more friendly, more positive?
More invasive. See,
finally, I've found an ally on this. Every week on the podcast, Ed and the guests talk about how great it would be if everybody talked to each other on public transport, whereas I am a strong advocate of not making eye contact with anybody.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell you, the Wangocracy and the Jeffocracy may be quite similar, actually.
Yeah, we could form a coalition.
Yeah.
All right, phasing out summer, you've got my vote. I suspect you
Thank
haven't
you.
Got Ed's.
No. Thank you. This one is quite relevant to what we've been talking about. You may only refer to your football team in the plural first person, i.e. we, ours, us, if you have at some point played for the club or at least had some sort of frontline job at the ground.
I'm sympathetic to this.
Okay.
I sort of agree with this. We won 2-0.
Yeah, I don't...
Or we won the World Series in my case. I think it's kind of problematic.
It's a tribalism in the most lazy fashion.
But people need things to associate with.
Well, associates in the club that I liked performed well.
Yeah,
don't hold back. You know what I mean? Don't get too excited.
I like the Beatles. I liked it last year when they reissued Sgt. Pepper's with all this extra stuff, but I didn't say, oh, great, we've released a new album.
That's a good
parallel to draw.
But you would say we about a country, would you? No,
but you,
would you?
But you regularly take part in what makes that country. I would not say you take part, aside
we
from
We got
your
to the World Cup semi-finals, would you say that?
Yes, I would.
You would say
I
that?
I would say that.
A logical flaw.
I would argue that a citizen has a more legitimate claim to their country and therefore the success of their national team than they would to a...
Barnsley, then.
Okay, then you're allowed to.
Oh, so you're allowed to. Barnsley, right? Okay.
This is what this course is for.
Exactly.
What the democratic process is.
I'm not sure what I think about it. I think sometimes it kind of slightly grates on me, but sometimes I sort of think, well, I'm probably responsible for it myself as well. I say we about the Red Sox, certainly.
And you had one last one.
One, and this is a bit more serious. I think British schools should teach children about the British Empire.
Definitely.
And the classes should all be in costume.
Can you talk a bit more about the last part for us?
Well, because you got to give kids a flavour for their history, right?
Right.
And to show that the British Empire wasn't all bad, you get to kick up a little khaki, you know? but that's, I stand by that, I think.
You went to school in...
Malaysia.
Right.
And Brunei.
Did you learn about the British Empire?
Glancing,
yeah,
really glancing. We learned about we'd learn more about the Dutch Empire than the British Empire.
Well, I didn't learn about the British Empire.
We've talked about this before. Like the only impression from school I ever got about the British Empire was, oh, it's great. We gave railways to all these countries.
I didn't even get that impression, to be honest. I mean, I think it's a problem.
I think it is a problem. I don't think that leaving it out of syllabuses contributes to a more positive or more negative view on the Empire.
No,
it just contributes to a less informed one.
No, I completely agree. There's certain attractions about living in the Wangocracy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's some parts of it that are I think I'd have to sort of flee the country. But there are parts of it that I quite like. Actually.
It's pretty high taxes as well.
Really?
Really high taxes,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. I'm in favour of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Phil, can you tell us about where people can find more Wang? What are you up to at the minute?
I'm in the current series of Taskmaster on Dave. I'm not at liberty to reveal how well I did. Bless you say, I didn't do as well as I'd hoped. Or as intelligently as one might expect from an engineer. So,
And we can also watch your next Netflix.
Yes, please. I'm on a series of mini comedy specials called The Comedy Lineup on Netflix. But if you search Phil Wang, it'll come up.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Good episode. Good to be back in the saddle.
It really is. I loved Phil there. That was he was great to spend some time with him. And I found this week's topic really interesting. Yeah. And I'm going to download Olio
definitely
onto my phone. I've got some tomato puree that I could do with. I don't think I'm going to use it up before it goes out of date.
So. And most of all, obviously, it's good to be back with me.
Well, there is that too. Yeah,
I mean, you meant to put that first.
Yeah, of course. I have missed you.
I have missed you too. Let's thank our guests, Lindsay Boswell and Sasha Celestial One.
And the marvellous Phil Wang. Emma Caution produces our podcast with backup and research from Alex Feisbrice and Lindsay Todd. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music and the art.
Emily Power.
Well, I think as far as first days back at school go, this wasn't a bad one.
Yep. He's been Jeff Lloyd.
He's been Ed Miliband.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.